So we have something called a prioritized last touch. So we look, we have a look back window. We see what all the customer, what were the touch points. And then within those touch points, we also give priority to certain channels. So that's another way of looking at attribution, giving equal weight to all of them.
Welcome to Growth Notes, presented by InBeat Agency. Each week, we discuss the essentials of D2C marketing, paid growth, and influencer strategies. Hear from consumer marketing industry leaders who provide transformative insights and share innovative advertising tactics that enhance e-commerce success.
All right, so today I'm joined by Ankur, who's a VP of Data Science at Poshmark. Ankur has a lot of understanding about data analytics and is going to be giving us a lot of light in the world of attribution and what it looks like today and how we can get around all the hurdles and bottlenecks we have. Ankur, thanks for being on the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, thanks, David, for the opportunity. I look forward to sharing what I have learned over the years.
All right, let's get to it. Can you tell me a little bit more about Poshmark and what you do there?
Sure, yeah. Poshmark is a leading fashion resale marketplace powered by a vibrant and engaged community of buyers and sellers. It was founded in 2011, and since then it has grown to a community of over 130 million users that has generated $10 billion in GMV, and sellers have realized multiple billions of earnings. And we're trying to build a sustainable future of fashion here. Here, as VP of Analytics and Data Science, I head the function, which partners closely with the three business lines of catalog business, ads revenue, and then live shopping. And then we work across all the functions, including core business, the growth, product, marketing, ops, and finance to help data-driven decision-making.
Yeah, I'd like to dig into that a little bit in terms of like live shopping and what that looks like. I know we have a lot of clients that are exploring TikTok Shop, and there's a lot of live shopping in there. And I'm curious, what's your take on the place of live shopping in the future of e-commerce?
Yeah, like shopping, I think let me just take a step back about why Poshmark is doing live shopping, right? We are committed to providing sellers multiple ways of getting their closets online. And what we realized is there is a huge gap in live commerce in the U.S., and the need for a platform that can be successfully helping people get their closets online in a simple and fun format that they like and prefer. And we introduced this in 2022, Q4 of 2022, and it quickly went on to become a key part of our business. It has grown to become a substantial portion and then continues to show tremendous growth and potential for our future.
Yeah, which makes sense in the industry and how you're operating. I think you're right. If you look at Asia as a market versus the United States in terms of live shopping, we're way behind in that part of the game. And I'm curious, how are you using live shopping at Poshmark to drive sales for your marketplace participants?
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the key things for live shopping is, besides providing a new way to sell, we have realized that continuous innovation seems to retain and attract both the sellers and the buyers. So we have created things like Posh Party Live, which is a next generation live shopping event where anybody can come in and sell and purchase from live shopping. A lot of hosts having these sessions where they're selling their items online. And then it combines the urgency of shows and bidding and auctions with the availability of millions of closets that are across the Poshmark, and they can all be brought in together in this framework. And then we also introduced something called Share Shows, where hosts are able to sell on behalf of somebody else. So I'm running my live shopping show, and David can share and listening to me, hey, can you sell this on my behalf? And I would be able to do that for you. This has not happened in the past. So I think this kind of innovation, this kind of new way of thinking of how live shopping should work is key to how we are trying to make it successful and probably where the future lies.
And how do you analyze? You're on the data science side, right? You do a lot of analysis and you're looking at data and you're trying to find trends and insights and whatnot. How do you analyze the impact of live shopping on the rest of the business? Are you measuring direct attribution? Okay, this is driving X amount of sales during the live stream,
or it's more, okay, this is building brand, it's bringing people back to the platform. I'm curious, what are you looking at when you're behind one of these initiatives on the data science side?
So a couple of things, like you mentioned, we do track the direct performance during the shows. Like how many hosts do we have? How many shows are being run? How many viewers are there? What kind of number and type of items that go for auctions? How much of them sell? What's our completion rate? And then eventually how much GMV that is generated or revenue that is generated during these shows. One of the key things, there is cannibalization. Like person who would have sold as a catalog business is also running a live show. So there is a bit of figuring out what is cannibalized versus what is truly new. And we did a bunch of analysis, including some pre-post, both in terms of engagement of sellers who were running shows versus who were not. How did their GMV change pre and post the launch of shows? And similarly, on the buyer or viewer side, users who are purchasing on shows, are they different than users who are not purchasing on shows? And how do the trend once they become a buyer on a live shopping event versus if they're not buyers on the live show?
Okay, so that's an interesting way to go at it because you're looking for net new shoppers, obviously, but I'm assuming you're also tracking, okay, are these legacy shoppers, catalog shoppers buying more with this live shopping experience versus are we increasing LTV on that side? And
Correct. Yes. And that is critical. And we have seen that anybody who gets hooked onto this new drug,
yeah,
they really like it. So they go all in on it.
Yeah. And what does a live shopping experience look like? Are sellers displaying products that they have as part of their catalog? What does it look like?
Yes. Right now we require a product to be in the catalog before it is displayed. We have also created a shortcut where you can do a quick listing. So just have an image of that listing. But typically, as a viewer, you can either buy in the auction when the host is displaying the listing, or you can go to their closet. We call all the listings you have in a closet, and you can explore that closet and do a buy now. So we have multiple options in which it can be displayed as well as purchased.
Okay, that's an interesting way to go at it. I know last time we spoke, I had a lot of questions about attribution modeling and how you do things. And I'm curious, how has it changed? You've been at this for quite some time. I'm curious, like, how has attribution changed? How do you think about it today versus iOS has always given us a new update that's making it harder to track anything? And I'm curious how that's changed through the years of like your attribution and how you think about it.
So there are two key methods to do attribution. Either you do go the MMM route, which is more top-down, high-level, or there is the multi-touch, which is more like event level, where you are attributing each and every action that the user does. And I think they are the two sides of the same coin. Let's say 2 decades ago, it was all MMM. We were just focused on doing multimedia modeling. We did not have access to these direct attributions. But as these, I would say, all the social platforms, Google, as they came up, it gave users the ability or advertisers the ability to track clicks across these properties. And then the focus shifted from being MMM-driven to a MTA-driven modeling. But everything kind of fell apart, like you said, when Apple said, oh no, sorry, no tracking. So it feels like we are going back to a world where there is some direct attribution available, let's say on Android, but a lot of it is reverting to media mix modeling, where you have to look at the overall picture and you augment it with some sort of experiments that you're doing, either on Facebook or some regional tests or some demographic tests. The future to me looks like more MMM world augmented with experimentations of different sorts.
Yeah, I'm getting the same read. And it's funny, I was looking at that on the agency side. So we measure leads coming in and we do initiatives like this podcast and we've got a lot of things in place. But if you look at just pure Google Analytics, like you get Final Touch, it's Google gets 100% of the credit, right? Somebody's going to go and Google our name and then you look. But then we get a lot of data in the B2B service side like us, as we ask people where they found us. And I'm sure you do the same on your side where people have found you. And it's just such a great source of data versus just looking at last touch attribution. And I agree with you. I think the brands we work with too are going with multimedia and it's okay, let's look at the entire marketing spend. Let's look at net new customers and then let's create a ratio from there and let's use last touch to evaluate tests within a platform, but not as a broad initiative.
So a couple of additional things there. So we have something called a prioritized last touch. So we have a look back window. We see what all the customer, what were the touch points. And then within those touch points, we also give priority to certain channels. So that's another way of looking at attribution, giving equal weight to all of them. Maybe Google is more or less, I don't know, depending on the situation, likely to be the initiator of a response from a user. Maybe our emails was the thing that triggered. So you prioritize some channels over the others to actually look at, assign the event to a channel that may not be the last or the first, something in between.
Yeah, yeah. And then you, in this specific model, do you, let's say we have 8 touch points within that 7-day window or whatever the window length is, do you give weight to each different touch point based on where it's at in the chain? How does that work? I'm curious.
So we have experimented with multiple. We are close to what we call the prioritized last touch. The last touch, but it should be based on a priority of channels that we have set internally that works for us. And historically, what I've seen in other places before Poshmark is you typically give equal weights. But what I prefer or recommend is giving time-based weights. Something that happened 48 hours ago versus 2 hours ago should have different weights. They cannot carry same weights because most recent touch did actually push you to press that buy button versus a 48-hour touch ago. Maybe it was more top of the funnel, it created the awareness, but the actual action happened in the last touch. But that doesn't mean if the 48-hour ago event did not happen, would you actually have reached this stage? So everybody needs to get something, but more closer to bottom of the funnel versus top of the funnel.
And then so these models are really fun to create, right? You're playing with the data and you're just moving the weights and you're playing with the decay. I'm curious, what is your end game? What is the end goal of creating one of these models? When do you say we've succeeded? This is the model we need. What is the end goal that we're after here?
Yeah, and it's a moving target, but typically the end goal is if I make a recommendation and if that is implemented, it gives the outcome that the model had predicted. And if it does not give that outcome, let's say I say move 10% of your money from Google to Facebook, and it will result in X extra users and reduce, let's say, Y buyers. If that scenario plays out exactly like I stated, then my model is where I want it to be for now. But a quarter down the line, that will not work. Because seasonality, because of other things that have come in, like external environment might have changed, user preferences might have changed, our product itself might have changed. So then you redo the thing and you figure out, oh, this is where I'm missing. Let me tune some parameters, sometimes extend the attribution window, give higher weights to certain channels over the other. And maybe there is an experiment we run in the last quarter, get that insight, and then retune the model.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, we're looking for predictions on how to properly attribute our budget or drive changes inside the org. And I'm curious, do you backtest your 50 different models on last 3 months data to create forward facing models? What does that look like?
A few months, let's say. And even if a small parameter changes, the input parameter, it would break the model. It won't work. Especially in, maybe it works in certain industries which are very stable, very seasonal in nature. I don't know, McDonald's sales, for example, Walmart sales for the other, but for more, I would say, reactive businesses or more real-time businesses that can change consumer behavior significantly, it has to be very near real-time, as much as you can do.
Yeah, which makes sense because you've got a lot of parameters to take into consideration and you don't want to pile it on a broken model. So I'm curious,
yeah, yep.
What are the other topics I really enjoyed during our previous talk was how you go at geo-specific modeling. So what do you, you analyze the marketing impact on a given geographic or whatever. How do you analyze that? How do you go at thinking of that problem and chunking it down and making the right predictions out of it?
We do large campaigns in the last 4 or 5 years. I think back in 2019 or 20, we took over New York subway. And then we did something in Houston a couple of years ago where we took over like a CBD. So lots of banners, posters, everywhere you go, you see Poshmark. So there are two approaches broadly we think of how we measure them. One is a simple pre-post. this is how this geo was trending, and post all this exciting campaigns, this is how it is trending. But it does not account for seasonality. So the other additional parameter that we include is something we call synthetic modeling here. So we try to find a geo that is very similar to the one where we are testing. So as an example, you do a test in LA and you compare the performance of LA with San Francisco or New York. So in that world, we have a like-for-like comparison, like as close as we can get. There is no way to test. So this is the best way you kind of create a synthetic control group. You try to make it as similar to your test group as possible. And then you see how the metrics moved in both of them and then get a sense of that. And then once you have a sense of what kind of benefit this led to, you take it back into your model and say, hey, TV spend does this to me. Outdoor spending, my parameter, let's say I had the exact 1.1x, it becomes 1.05 to 1.15, any of those values.
Yeah, because ideal scenario would be you turn off the ad budget altogether, then you see what the baseline is. And then after that, that's not the real world. You can't do that.
No, yeah, we can't do that, right? That's the fun of marketing.
Yeah, exactly. And then on that topic, how do you analyze different cohorts? Are you measuring impacts on cohorts? If you take, okay, let's compare San Francisco with LA, we're running a test in LA. Are you looking at similar cohorts in both cities? You have buyer personas, obviously. You can segment. What does that look like, that segmentation exercise look like in that same test?
Yes, and this probably applies to more than just the test. It also applies to business performance in general. And we can say it is death by 100 cuts. So we keep slicing the data as much as we can. Cohort is one thing you had mentioned. App is the other thing. Like, are they using iOS, Android, or web? Are they registered on the platform via mobile or via web? That's another signal we use. And then there could be other more, I would say, demographic ones. If you have the information, gender is one. You can also use age and exact location if they have the DMA provided. Some of those inputs also go in. And then you also have some segments based on their activity on the platform. So are they buyers? Are they sellers? Are they both? How active buyers they are? How active sellers they are? So you use all of those segments to break down your data and see whether a certain campaign has impacted a particular segment more than the other. And that's where the true insight comes. Like, this kind of thing appeals only to, let's say, a frequent buyer on Poshmark who lives in metro areas. Like, that could be an insight coming out of a campaign when you do all these segmentations.
Okay, interesting. And like, if you had to choose, let's say, three metrics, three data points you have access to build the best model, like, well, what's the 80-20 here in terms of attribution? What would you look at?
So for Poshmark?
Yeah, for Poshmark. I mean, let's say Poshmark. I'm curious. Yeah.
Yeah. So everybody has a North Star metric. For us, since it's a marketplace, we will look at the outcome metric, which is GMV, how much transactions are happening on Poshmark. So I will model that against what's happening on the platform. And then since it's a marketplace and buyers are important to me, listers are important to me. So I would model against buyers and listers, how they are impacted via different campaigns. And the inputs to all of this would be our spend mix across awareness, which is TV, outdoor, radio, and then digital, social, and then the transactional, which is the GDM or Google campaigns. So three core buckets of spend. And fourth could be our email campaigns or internal own channels and how our buyers and sellers and listers perform against those.
Which makes sense. These are the core components of a marketplace and what you need to do. And I'm curious, what are these power user events user experience that you measure? Like, user does three purchases, they're now a power user. What are these events that are marked as key events for you in terms of analyzing?
So we actually do not have them. We don't have events per se, like the frequency events. What we have seen is somebody who becomes both a buyer and a seller retains significantly better, which makes sense. Like, you are excited about both sides of the platform. You make a purchase and you also want to sell the same thing on Poshmark. So that is our key, I would say, measure of success from a user perspective, somebody who are, we are able to activate both as a buyer and seller.
Interesting. So is, and you don't need to give exact numbers here, but how many of your users roughly are both buyers and sellers?
It's a pretty significant number. I wouldn't be able to disclose that.
Yeah, obviously
that
not
here,
yet. But... I was testing the waters. Yeah, it makes sense, right? Because like if I think about your ideal customer, like it completely makes sense. They're participating in fashion and luxury retail in some capacity. So they're either buying or selling and it makes sense.
It's a lot about circular fashion too. So you buy the same item, you use it for a couple of times and then you sell it on Poshmark. And we have a lot of programs which says resell on Poshmark. Oh, you purchased this, do you want to sell it now? So it's encouraging users to go into that circular commerce versus kind of use it once and discard it.
So wear high quality clothes and then sell them and buy more high quality clothes. And that's the name of the game. So you're always wearing some great clothes, which is a great selling point.
It's something fresh, like clothes, accessories, shoes, bags, like whatever.
Yeah, exactly. As part of the data team, like, there's a lot of challenges, obviously, and one of them, and this what I've seen is getting people to take action on the data. Like, how do you ensure that the data flows to the right the department to make the right decisions? I'm curious how you think about that. What's the business case for data? How do you make sure it's implemented? How do you make sure that, yeah, it drives the outcome you're looking for?
Yeah, and I think it's a great point. And a lot of data teams stumble at this hurdle. They have something fantastic to do, show, but they have nobody to listen to them and take action on whatever they have done. And I think it starts with empathy, which is you understand if you're creating a product or a solution, whom are you creating for and what are their pain points? Is something troubling them and right now or something that's going to be important for them in the future? So going around, understanding what people are thinking, like gathering that knowledge before you embark on creating any solution is very important, right? And the second thing along that path is aligning with the business partners, what you're going to do, what will be the outcome and how it can be used, and educating them that, hey, we have this data. You might not know, but we have this data that can help you answer this question. Like multiple times I've seen in the past, hey, oh, I have this data. I didn't know I could use this input to drive this outcome for myself. So educating your business partners that this is all that exists. These are the kind of questions I can answer for you. And these are the kind of solutions I can make for you. And then going back to the first point on empathizing with them and figuring out what's their pain point is very important. And the next thing that comes after this is, let's say you have aligned, you've created this solution. How do you communicate it to the partner? If you say, hey, y is equal to x squared plus 3 sigma times whatever, like, okay, I don't understand that. I cannot use it. So you have to communicate it in a very simple language, in a language that whoever you are talking to understands, right? It cannot be complex. It has to be very simple, very business oriented, and very actionable. Hey, this is what I'm suggesting. This is what it means for you. And this is how you can benefit from this insight. These three things together, I think, would solve for or help you go across this hurdle.
Yeah, do you have any rules of thumb of like, hey, you know, like we keep the math away, like we visualize it in a one pager? Or do you have any rules of thumb where you're like, okay, like we got to keep this simple to keep people's attention?
Yeah, we have the rule of three, which is standard in communications, like no more than 3 points, digest or take away or retain. So it has to be not more than 3 insights. Let's say keep it in 3 slides if possible. And yeah, it should not touch more than 3 departments. If you say, hey, sales need to give this, finance needs to give this, marketing needs to give this, and then product needs to change this thing, that's never going to happen. Or it will take 2 years.
Even 3 is a stretch. Even 3 is a stretch. Yeah. Yeah, because then you need to put all of that together, string it, and yeah, it's going to be a lot of follow-ups.
I agree with that.
So I'm curious, how are you guys using, there's a lot of talk about AI, especially LLMs these days, and I'm curious, how are you guys using AI right now at Poshmark? And what does that look like in terms of different team uses and whatever you got? I'm just curious.
Sure. So there are multiple things we are doing, right? We have a product, or not a product, it's like a feature and email or a section on the feed called Just Picked For You. So it's a widget on the app. It's an email that goes out, but it highlights the items we feel are more relevant for you. It is based on what we have identified our products that will appeal to the consumer based on their past behaviors, based on the price points they have interacted with, the categories they have interacted with, right? So that is one place where we're using. We have something called a smart list, which is you take a picture of an image and it will generate a listing for you. So that's another place where we are integrating the AI use case. And then we have used it for localizing some of our campaigns in the past. So you record one of the sessions or in one language, and then you can customize the language for other regions. We have also used to figure out what is the right time to communicate to a particular person. So using, let's say you wake up at 6 a.m., I wake up at 9 a.m. So depending on your past interaction history, what is the right time to talk to you? Right, that's another place we have used. And then some things are being used by Facebook and Meta directly, which we were doing in the past, which is they are picking up the right titles, they are picking up the right image to show to a specific user to increase the engagement and conversion.
Yeah, so some pretty interesting use cases. It makes sense for a marketplace. Take a picture, generate a listing. You've got so much data already to build that product listing and train a model on that it's makes the platform a lot easier to use for your users and more enjoyable too. And I find, yeah, Gen AI in terms of advertising is such a good way to advertise, because you can just test multiple different variations of an ad very quickly. And then you can test it in so many languages, and whatever works, then you can go and refine with real actors if needed and so forth. So very good iterative tool to run advertising efforts. I agree with that. I agree with that a lot. And then where's the future of data analytics going? Obviously, there's going to be AI baked into it. There's been AI for a while. Now it's just because LLMs made it super popular, but there's been AI in data analytics for a very long time. So I'm curious, what do you see the future of data analytics look like, and how is it going to empower companies?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great time. Like a few years ago, McKinsey had the article that data scientist is the sexiest job of the decade or whatever, right? I think this is just taking it further. We have these fantastic tools. I think LLM is a tool for analysts. It's not the end, say, like it doesn't solve anything directly for you. Like you have to use it appropriately to make yourself more efficient. I think it gives the augmentation that can convert an analyst to a super analyst, and they can do 50% more things. They can do it more efficiently. Probably it can help you write a lot better than you used to write in the past. That's one thing that analysts have typically struggled: how to communicate, how to write, what's the right language. It can help there. But I don't feel the core of the analyst's job is going away. Curiosity, like what am I looking for? And then the intent to navigate different scenarios, like how can I find the solution I'm looking for? I think those things will still differentiate these analysts versus super analysts. And then how they can fulfill some of that curiosity and intent using LLMs would be very interesting.
Yeah, I got that feeling too. It's an enabling technology for now. If you're not curious, or if you're not a good analyst to start with, not going to make you a super analyst just by the fact that it exists, but it can help a great analyst be an extraordinary analyst. And that's a feeling I've got and I've seen people use. And the people that are good and that are using it are just significantly better. And it doesn't make everybody significantly better in the same way.
Yeah, it doesn't take away your first principles thing.
Exactly.
Like, what does this mean? How do you think about it? How to solve this problem? If you don't ask the right question, you will just keep getting the same answer again and again.
And that curiosity you talked about, which is important in so many roles, is like what's going to make you good at using LLMs or ChatGPT or Claude or whatever you use. And that's like that curiosity is what's going to make you a great user of LLM. So it's that unifying trait that you're looking for essentially in people.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. I do not have any more questions on my list, Ankur. This was a real treat. I know we're coming up to time, so we did this in the right amount of time. I appreciate you taking the time today. Before we leave, where can people find you?
Thank you, David. And I'm on LinkedIn, and that's the best source to reach me. and find me on LinkedIn, ping me, and we love to connect with a lot of you and learn from you and share whatever I have learned.
Yeah, Ankur is a brilliant data guy. He knows a lot, and it's been a treat for me to talk with you. Have a good one.
Thanks, David. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Growth Notes. You can find links to all the resources mentioned in today's episode in the show notes. If you're finding value in our podcast, please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us reach more listeners like you. Don't miss out on any insights. Keep listening and growing with us.